probably our responsibility if we have statutory requirements that providers provide services that we make the payments.
The House votes to sustain Medicaid payments. From Alaska Public Media, this is Statewide News on Alaska News Nightly for Monday, March 12th. Good evening, I'm Lori Townsend. Also tonight, Trump's proposed tariffs could shake up Alaska's economy.
If the cost of the final product goes up, then demand may fall as consumers either cut back on that product or substitute.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station.
The Bristol-based Subsistence Regional Advisory Council will discuss possible federal subsistence fish and shellfish proposals and other subsistence-related issues and invites public participation at a meeting March 13th and 14th starting at 8:30 a.m. at Dolly's Hall in Naknek. More at doi.gov/subsistence/regions. This message sponsored by the Office of Subsistence Management.
The House today passed an extra funding bill to allow the state to make Medicaid payments to hospitals and the Alaska Marine Highway System to operate through spring. The bill is known as the, quote, Fast Track Supplemental, end quote. It would appropriate $110 million. That includes $45 million the House added in an amendment today to pay for Medicaid. Hospital advocates have expressed concern that some small hospitals wouldn't be able to pay their bills if the legislature doesn't pass the Medicaid funding. Homer Majority Caucus Republican Paul Seaton says the state made a commitment to those providers.
That's why this $45 million is in the budget now, and that is, you know, probably our responsibility if we have statutory requirements that providers provide services that we make the payments.
Eagle River Minority Caucus Republican Laura Reinbold opposed the amendment to fund Medicaid and the overall bill. She noted the large number of Alaskans enrolled in Medicaid.
Now they're dependent on a government that is growing out of control. We have a recession going on, and every dollar that we spend, every single dollar that we spend, whether it's federal or state dollars, comes out of the private sector. And a lot of the private sector people can't afford health insurance.
The bill also includes $24 million for the ferry system and $18 million for the Department of Corrections. The House voted 32-7 on the bill. All of the no votes were cast by representatives from Matanuska-Susitna Borough or Eagle River. It now heads to the Senate. How will President Trump's steel and aluminum tariffs affect Alaska? In at least one sector, the impacts are real. Coast Alaska's Ed Schoenfeld reports.
Homer's Bay Weld Boats makes custom aluminum watercraft from 60-foot tenders to 22-foot seine skiffs. So, General Manager Eric Ingebretson has been keeping an eye on plans for a 10% tariff on imported aluminum. He's not alone.
Supply chain heard this was potentially going to happen back in early January, and the whole marine aluminum supply chain started to adjust itself and prepare itself for this.
His company buys sheet aluminum from a local supplier. He says his understanding is it's manufactured in the United States. But that hasn't made any difference. Bay Weld and other aluminum users started buying up supplies in advance of the announcement.
35%, and in some cases 50-60% increase in our pricing structure of purchasing aluminum.
The second-generation business owner hopes the hikes will level out soon, but he's not counting on it. He says that will increase prices on the 12-18 custom boats his employees make in a year. Alaska has a number of other aluminum boat builders. Other businesses make or repair steel ships, including Vigor Marine, which runs the Ketchikan Shipyard. That's where state ferries have much of their work done, including rusty steel replacement. Trump's imported steel tariff is 25%. Ora Landau is a spokeswoman for the State Department of Transportation, which includes the ferry system.
DOT doesn't expect that tariffs will impact our state transportation. DOT doesn't purchase foreign steel because we operate under the Buy America program.
Beyond shipbuilding, Alaska businesses fabricate fuel tanks and other goods out of embargoed metals, but not a lot.
We tend to have a pretty small manufacturing industry in Alaska.
State economist Karina Wiebold says the tariffs could still drive up prices, and that will affect stores, warehouses, and other sellers. She says their response could shake up sectors of our economy.
If the cost of the final product goes up, then demand may fall as consumers either cut back on that product or substitute for something that's comparatively lower cost.
That's also the case for steel and aluminum used in bridges, buildings, ports, pipelines, and other public projects.
Road construction, airport construction, that's still very healthy, and it's been under the Buy America Act for years.
John McKinnon is executive director of the Alaska chapter of Associated General Contractors. He says prices change for a variety of reasons. Tariffs, such as Trump's, are only one type of variable in his industry.
Will it make much difference? Not from the practices that we've been going on for the last few years.
Back at Homer's Bay Weld Boats, General Manager Ingebretson says some in the business are scratching their heads.
There was a political layer to this that really wasn't driven by the industry itself. The industry didn't ask for the aluminum pricing to be adjusted. It was kind of something that was forced on us, and now here we are.
He's already considered how much he'll have to raise his prices. It could be 5 to 10%. He says that's not out of line with other adjustments for inflation. I'm Ed Schoenfeld, reporting in Juneau.
The Alaska Mental Health Trust is considering a land agreement with the developers of the Donlin Gold Prospect in southwest Alaska. The trust would hand over control of nearly 2,000 acres of Cook Inlet land to Donlin. Conserving land in South Central would give the proposed mine the right to disrupt wetlands at the mine site north of Crooked Creek in an entirely different part of the state. The mine would affect an estimated 2,800 acres of wetlands there. The land agreement is what's known as a mitigation offset. Under the proposed agreement, the Alaska Mental Health Trust would continue to own the Cook Inlet land and maintain subsurface rights to it. The trust would hold the land for up to a decade for an annual fee of $20,000 while Donlin tries to get permits. Once construction began, if it does, the agreement would bar any surface development on the land located near the village of Tionic for at least 99 years in exchange for a $1.5 million payment to the trust. Activities like hunting, fishing, and hiking could continue. The Alaska Mental Health Trust is collecting public comment on the proposed agreement through April 12th. A search continues near Juneau for two missing climbers who did not return from their ascent of the Mendenhall Towers last week. Winter weather has made it difficult for rescuers to search for Ryan Johnson of Juneau and Marc-Andre Leclerc of British Columbia on the Mendenhall Ice Field. They were due back last Wednesday, the same day a snowstorm hit Juneau. Johnson and Leclerc were dropped off near the towers on March 4th and were due to return 3 days later via the West Glacial Trail. Both are experienced climbers, but neither carried a satellite phone or emergency beacon with them for the trip. Family and friends last heard from them on March 5th. The Alaska State Troopers were notified on Wednesday that the pair did not return. Searchers located some of their gear on the ice field last week, but poor weather prevented search efforts on Saturday. Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, an Alaska Paralympian becomes first from the state to win gold.
I've always been a go-getter, and winning gold has always been the number one thing. I'm out there to do my best.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by
Alaska Pipeline Service Company, operating the 800-mile Trans-Alaska Pipeline since 1977. One of the greatest honors for a public media station is delivering on its promise to provide quality programming and news you can trust to the communities it serves. What you hear on air is the result of a dedicated team working together to bring you the best. It's a privilege to be a part of your day. Thank you for listening, for your feedback, and for your support.
There's been a shakeup along the Iditarod Trail. Bad weather along the coast earlier today hampered the race's frontrunners. Nicholas Petit, who was the first out of Unalakleet on Sunday evening, was overtaken by Yor Leithseth Olsom on the way into Koyuk. Alaska Public Media's Zachariah Hughes is on the line to help break down what's happening. Hi, Zach.
Hello, Lori.
So first of all, we don't have a GPS tracker on you like the mushers in the race, but where are you? Because you're not where the action is in Koyuk.
No, I am in Unalakleet, and so is most of the press corps, because we can't take off. The weather that's affecting the race up at the top of the pack is also grounding a lot of the smaller planes that reporters and just plenty of other people too rely on to get around. I'm in Unalakleet, kind of talking to some of the mid and backpack mushers today. Two ADN reporters were in a plane early this morning and got pretty close to Koyuk, and then it was whiteout conditions, and they had to turn back and head to Unalakleet.
Zach, what happened with the front runners earlier today?
What we know is all based on GPS tracking and then some of the videos that the Iditarod Insider has posted. And what we saw was earlier in the day, Nick Petit suddenly kind of zigged eastward on the run between Shaktulik and Koyuk. And he headed a couple of miles east towards the land away from the sea ice, and then kind of doubled back and lost a bunch of time. And in the time that he was doing that, Yor Olsen passed him and shot out in front and ended up getting to Koyuk about an hour before Nick did, which is notable because Nick had a lead leaving Unalakleet, and a run that took Nick 13 hours between Shaktulik and Koyuk only took Yor 8 hours. So because of Nick's wrong turn, it seems like he lost his lead.
And who's behind them? Now there's been this switch, Yor's in front.
And not far behind them is Mitch Seavey, who was also out of Unalakleet. He was in a little bit before Yor to Unalakleet yesterday and was out a little bit after him. And he, as you and I are speaking, he's just about to Koyuk. He'll almost inevitably be there for a little while, posted up in third with a couple of hours behind those two. And those are the top three. Those are who we've been watching for the last several checkpoints, last several days, kind of jockey for position number one. Behind them is a really, really strong, aggressive, hungry chase pack. And I wouldn't be surprised if one of the people in fourth or fifth maybe moved into that top three, especially with all of the weather variables happening right now.
Well, as we know, things can still change before winners get to Nome. But when is a winner expected to arrive in Nome?
Lori, that is a $50,000 question. The last time this race was run in 2013, Mitch Seavey arrived in Nome at about 10:30 p.m. on Tuesday night. This year's race is at least 3 hours behind last year's. And Mark Nordman, who's in charge of the trail for the Iditarod Trail Committee, thinks that it's probably going to be sometime early on Wednesday. So we're talking 1, 2 a.m. That's because based on this race being a couple of hours slower than the 2013 race, he's just tacking on time to what happened in 2013. But every step is slower. So I think we are pushing further into Wednesday when mushers reach Nome. This has been an exceptionally slow year.
That was Alaska Public Media's Zachariah Hughes reporting from Unalakleet. An Alaska skier won gold at the Paralympics in Pyeongchang over the weekend. Andrew Kirka's first place finish in the men's downhill race was also the first medal ever for an Alaskan athlete at the Winter Paralympic Games. Alaska Public Media's Emily Russell reports.
Andrew Kirka started dreaming of the Olympics when he was just 8 years old. Here's Kirka in a video on YouTube.
I was an avid wrestler, always competing, always being active.
Kirka grew up in Palmer and put everything he had into wrestling. He was a six-time state wrestling champion by the time he was a teenager. But then at 13, his Olympic dreams came crashing down. Kirka was out on a fishing trip at Jim Creek, east of Palmer, when his four-wheeler flipped and landed on top of him. Kirka broke his back and was paralyzed from the waist down. He says that's when a physical therapist encouraged him to try Paralympic skiing.
I loved it, and I dedicated everything to it. I knew I wanted to be the best skier in the world.
This YouTube video is produced by the Paralympic Games. Kirka qualified for the 2014 Winter Paralympics in Sochi when he was 22 years old. But then another accident. In his first downhill training run in Sochi, Kirka crashed and broke his back again.
My Sochi experience, my very first Paralympic experience, the chance for me to really prove myself and make all my dreams come true, definitely fell short when I broke my back in the first downhill training run.
Kirka calls the experience a black cloud. He says it hung over him for years. But he went to more physical therapy and got back on the ski slopes. Just last year, Kirka won gold in downhill at the World Championships in Italy.
Andrew Kirka picks up World Championship gold.
Winning my very first World Championship was a huge honor. It felt like a little bit of the weight from Sochi had been lifted off my shoulders.
So it's no surprise that Kirka came to the 2018 Winter Paralympic Games with a medal on his mind. And after nearly two decades, Kirka's dream came true on Friday. The wrestler turned skier won gold in the men's downhill, earning the first medal ever from the Winter Paralympic Games for his home state of Alaska.
I've always been a go-getter, and winning gold has always been the number one thing. I'm out there to do my best.
And Kirka didn't stop with gold. The next day, he won silver in the Super Giant Slalom, or Super G, on Saturday. Kirka plans to compete in two more events at the Paralympic Games, the men's Super Combined Super G on Tuesday and the Giant Slalom on Wednesday. In Anchorage, I'm Emily Russell.
Governor Bill Walker's office signed a letter last week asking the federal government to declare the 2018 Pacific cod fishery in the Gulf of Alaska a disaster. It follows a decline in stock and a deep cut to the 2008 Pacific cod quota in the Gulf. Barbara Blake, senior advisor to Governor Walker, says the resulting drop in revenue makes the fishery eligible for a disaster declaration.
We do know that this year, the numbers based on the closures that have already been enacted, that the closures are going to equate our catch of Pacific cod to the 80% threshold, which is a requirement for a disaster declaration at the federal level.
According to the letter from Governor Walker, the value of the 2018 Pacific cod harvest is looking at a more than 80% drop in revenue from the five-year average. Blake says the letter will go to the Secretary of Commerce, and if successful, the federal government will work out with the state to make an appropriation request.
How we've seen this come about in the past is that that request goes in along with other natural disasters, and that's usually how we end up getting the appropriations for that, is that they roll it into natural disasters like hurricane relief and things of that nature.
That's also how the fishery disaster for the 2016 Gulf of Alaska pink salmon season won funding this year. It's unclear if the timeline for this declaration will be comparable. The effort to reform the Alaska Marine Highway System took a step forward last week. The House Transportation Committee voted to ask staff to draft legislation that would establish a public corporation to take over the system, but it's a long way from a done deal. The ferries are run by the State Department of Transportation. The plan would shift control to an independent board that could make its own decisions about labor contracts, fares, and other parts of the operation. It would also forward fund the system, allowing for better schedule planning. Anchorage Republican Representative Chuck Kopp says a seven-member board of experts would provide better oversight than 60 ever-changing members of the legislature.
Imagine if we were trying to run the Anchorage International Airport as a legislature. It would be a disaster, but it's the number four air cargo airport in the world and entirely successful.
Big Lake Republican Representative Mark Newman says he's intrigued by the bill, but he's not ready to ask for it.
You know, there's still a lot of questions to be answered, and this is something that's going to take massaging of a couple of years, you know, to work through, and I can understand how that can work, let alone trying to figure out how we're going to come up with a couple hundred million dollars for a fund.
The committee voted 5-2 in favor of writing a reform bill. It will be discussed and modified at future meetings, but action will likely wait until the next legislative session.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by
ConocoPhillips, investing and exploring on the North Slope and creating economic opportunities for Alaskans. ConocoPhillips, unlocking Alaska's energy resources.
The Alaska Commission on Post-Secondary Education offers the Alaska Supplemental Education Loan for students attending most college or training programs in or outside of Alaska, and it offers interest rates lower than the Federal Plus. For more information, call 800-441-2962 or visit acpe.alaska.gov/radio. This message sponsored by the Alaska Commission on Post-Secondary Education, Alaska's higher education state agency.
Thank you. In the 1980s, a gathering of a few traditional village dance groups in Bethel started what may now be the world's largest gathering of Alaska Native dancers, the Chamai Dance Festival. The elders that kept the drums pounding through the generations remain the roots of this tradition. In just a few days, the drums will beat again. KYUK's Anna Rose MacArthur sat down with two of Chamai organizers to discuss how this year's festival honors its foundation.
The festival seems to grow stronger every year, as longtime co-coordinator Linda Curta remembers well.
You know, originally people would just dance in their t-shirts and maybe have dance fans, you know, and then we had gloves and, you know, now we have matching cuspucks and everyone, men and women, have fans, mukluks, then the headdresses, most incredible beaded headdresses.
This year, for the first time, Chamai is dedicated to a group of elders who together represent the continuum of dance in their village. For decades, it has been customary to find a departed elder to dedicate the festival to. But when organizers turned to Kasigluk to name someone, the Tundra village with a strong dancing tradition instead named Six.
They are York in Kasigluk.
Kakelnguk, that's Kalila Slim. Askilak, Nelly Slim. Uksunkhiah, Wasley Berlin Sr. Kalichtuk, Wasley Nicholas. Nasakak, Alexei Nicholas. Ukilak, Pavla Nicholas.
That's Peter Achek, who helps facilitate Chamai. The festival begins on March 16th at the Bethel Regional High School Gym. As the host, Bethel dancers will take the stage first to welcome their guest. The lineup includes local and regional groups, as well as past favorites from out of town, like the Running Thunder Cree dancers from Canada and the Nanda Acrobaticalist.
They're just amazing.
In one act, two sets of men on opposite sides of the stage stand on one another's shoulders and juggle objects across the room. Chamai celebrates dance from around the world. For the first time, it'll welcome Pacific Bloom, a Polynesian group. 21 groups will perform. On the second day, they'll all come together for the Heart of the Drums, a ceremony that goes well with this year's Chamai theme.
Dupachtlaret Nunavipput, which in English translates to drums awaken our roots.
The drummers from all the dance groups stand on the top row of the bleacher circling the crowd and in unison begin to beat their drums, growing louder and louder.
When you're watching that, you will forget there is a world out there. Healing happens.
Chamai means handshake in Yupik and is said as a warm welcome. The festival celebrates community and tradition. It's multi-generational, multilingual, and multicultural. To everyone, it says Chamai.
It's a festival. Come have fun, everyone.
In Bethel, I'm Anna Rose MacArthur.
It may not feel like winter is over, but climatological winter wrapped up at the end of February. That's the three-month season, December, January, and February, that climatologists call winter in the Northern Hemisphere. Brian Bretschneider with our Ask a Climatologist segment says defining a standard winter season is important for tracking big-picture climate trends. He says in Alaska, temperatures were significantly above normal for most of the state.
So if you look at, say, the northern half of the mainland, many stations were 8, 10, even up to 14 degrees above normal up on the North Slope. So Dead Horse, Uptiogvik, Kuparik, they were all like 12, 13 degrees, 14 degrees above normal. And even down toward, farther down into the interior, McGrath, about 11 degrees above normal. Fairbanks, about 8 degrees above normal for the December through February period. So that's significantly above normal. Farther south toward Anchorage, you know, about 3 to 4 degrees above normal. So the mainland part south of the Alaska Range was notably above normal, but not as extreme as the northern half of the state. And then actually down in southeast, there were some places that were actually a little bit below normal. But on bulk, the state on average was about 7 degrees above normal for the December through February period.
And what about winter snow?
So snow, we've actually had a pretty good snow winter. So if we look at, say, just the December through February period, on average, stations are running, you know, about 110 or 120% of normal, so above normal. Now, interestingly, for the precipitation, so if you take that snow and you melt it, the average is about 140% of normal. So well, we have this situation where some places maybe mixed in a little bit of rain, but I think in most cases we've actually had a little bit wetter snow. So if you're warmer, that snow isn't going to be quite as fluffy. So that way our precipitation totals have been outpacing our snowfall totals. Another interesting thing is our snow depth has actually been doing really well. Our snow depth is kind of outperforming our snowfall, which is an interesting little side note.
And in Anchorage, the snow kind of had a comeback late in the season this year. Is that true for the rest of the state as well?
Well, February was a really snowy month here in Anchorage. I think we had about 25 inches. Fairbanks also had about 23 or 24 inches. So a lot of snow in February. Juneau had a fair amount, and they've actually kept the snow depth for an extended period of time. So that's pretty noteworthy for snow in February. Here in Anchorage, we've actually, if you look at the point where half the season's snow fell before and then half after, so far, that's actually, that date is into February, which is kind of pretty late in the season. Probably still won't catch up to the seasonal annual total in Anchorage, but up for the north in Fairbanks, they're already, you know, if it didn't snow anymore, they're already running about 10 inches above what a full normal snowfall would be. So they're having a big snow year up there for sure.
Brian Bretschneider is a climatologist in Anchorage. He checks in with Alaska's Energy Desk each week as part of a regular look at climate change in the state. If you have a climate-related question, send an email to akenergydesk@alaskapublic.org. And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at alaskapublic.org/news. We had reports tonight from Andrew Kitchenman, Ed Schoenfeld, and Adeline Baxter in Juneau, Anna Rose MacArthur in Bethel, Kayla DeRoche in Kodiak, Zachariah Hughes in Unalakleet, and Emily Russell and Annie Fite in Anchorage. Our audio engineer is Dave Waldron. Wesley Early is our web editor, and I'm Lori Townsend. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible in part by your local public radio station.
Opioids are common prescription pain relievers and must be used properly to avoid danger. Common opioids include hydrocodone, oxycodone, morphine, fentanyl, and codeine. Safely getting rid of unused opioid medication prevents children and pets from accidental poisoning and protects the environment. Information about safe opioid storage and proper disposal is at opioids.alaska.gov. This message is sponsored by the State of Alaska Department of Health and Social Services. The University of Alaska Anchorage is investing in Alaska by equipping students with the knowledge and tools for academic success. These students will go on to be the doctors, nurses, teachers, engineers, and artists of Alaska who shape the future of the state by bringing new solutions, inventions, and ideas to the table. Amazing stories are being written every day at UAA. More information at uaa.alaska.edu/admissions. This message sponsored by UAA.
Support for public radio comes from the communities we serve. Whether you give as an individual member or through your business, know that your contribution makes possible programming that informs, inspires, and entertains. We thank you for the role you play in your public radio station. This is Statewide News on Alaska Public Media.